Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you check out the events page. Scroll down to that Here We Still Stand regional event in Bentonville, Arkansas, known as NWA. That's Northwest Arkansas. And you can come hang out with Chad, myself, a whole bunch of other 1517 folks for 2 days. In, you know, basically the best place since Eden. You know, you want to check that out. You know, you don't want to live life in a fallen world without at least checking out, you know, the best thing since Eden, which that would be, of course, where I live. I mean, I didn't choose to live here for no reason. I'm not that kind of person. So come check it out. And that's the first weekend in May. We'll have a good time. You'll enjoy it. Chad, we are in the first chapter of Job. We did a bunch of kind of talking about the book, laying down some stuff, and got into the first initial part of this story, which, of course, is you got a guy, seems like a real good guy. I mean, maybe talked about as well as anyone in Scripture is talked about, and he's a blameless guy. He's upright. He's in the land of Uz. He's not part of Israel. He's just out there loving God, you know, making sure that his kids are walking in the ways of the Lord, you know, doing a couple of sacrifices just in case, you know, they mess up along the way. And God's pretty proud of this guy. He's pretty aware of what he's doing. And so when the devil shows up one day from, you know, roaming around like a prowling lion, God points Job out, which is exactly probably what we find you do not want God to do. This is not something you want him to do to you. Maybe. Not that most of us, I think, have to worry about this, but it may not be the best thing in the world for you to be the most righteous person in the world. God might point you out to the devil. The devil might say, you know what, let me play a couple games with him. Why don't you lower that hedge of protection you got around him and let me at him for a little while, and we'll see just how faithful this guy turns out to be. This is kind of where we ended, that God said, all right, you go ahead and have at him. Here's the one rule. You can do kind of whatever you want, but you can't kill him. Which, of course, somewhere in the middle, Job might be wondering, why am I not dead yet?
Yeah, well, I mean, as soon as we get past chapter 2, he curses the day of his birth. So I think that's pretty obvious that I wish that I were dead. I wish, in fact, I had not even existed as where he's at. And that's quite a leap between chapter 2 and 3, because at the end of chapter 2, I mean, even his wife can't convince him to basically commit suicide by cursing God. That's more or less what she's encouraging him to do. But yeah, we'll get there. First of all, we have to go through this first series of losses. So there'll be two losses. The first are all of these losses that are described in Job 1:13 and following. And then after that, we'll have the loss of Job's health, which is pretty grotesque, actually, when you start looking at all the things that happened to him. So, verse 13. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. So we've already heard how they kind of took turns. You know, so this Saturday, where are we going to be? My place. So they all get together. Whether it was special days or birthdays, whatever it was, they'd all get together.
Doesn't this kind of imply like a closeness to this family, which sort of adds to how kind of terrible all of this is? I mean, you are talking about, you know, he's got a lot of kids, and they seem that they all take turns like having dinner parties at each other's houses, and so this family does seem like a family that is at peace with one another. They seem close.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important thing to keep in mind, especially in these first two chapters, that, you know, everything that is described about Job and about his family, it's just as the cream of the crop. I mean, maybe we could make an argument with regard to his wife. But just as far as the kids go and Job goes, I mean, it's just like you said at the beginning, no one else in Scripture is described in this way.
Yep.
No one else is ranking quite on the scale of righteousness that Job is, apart from Christ himself. So anyway, they're together. All the kids they're having a, you know, they're get together, they're party, they're eating, drinking wine, enjoying themselves. And there came a messenger to Job, the first of many, first of four. And he said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of your sword, edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. So this I alone have escaped to tell you is going to be the phrase that recurs throughout the section. Each time a messenger shows up, he's going to tell Job some terrible thing that's happened. And then to accent the fact that this was a near total destruction, then the messenger will say, I'm the only one who escaped. So the Sabaeans come along, and the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. So they come and they take the livestock, which Job is not only very righteous, but he's also very rich. So he has a bunch of livestock. So he's just lost his oxen, just lost his donkeys, and the servants, struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. Presumably the servants would have been armed and they tried to defend themselves and the flock, and the Sabaeans, whoever they were, they cut them down, probably from the Arabian Peninsula. So that's first. And then each of these is stacked on top of each other. So it's like this messenger shows up and he barely finishes delivering the report. And then another servant runs up and he's out of breath because he's been retreating from this terrible thing that's happened. And so he begins to talk. So you got to imagine Job is hearing one, and then barely they finish, somebody else shows up with the next message. So while he was yet speaking, verse 16, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven. I'm assuming that this refers to lightning, as the fire from God does elsewhere. So some kind of terrible storm, lightning storm. The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. So everybody's burned up. And once more, I alone have escaped to tell you. So two down. Verse 17. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans, so people from kind of the area of Mesopotamia, the Chaldeans formed three groups, made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. So the taking of livestock, destruction of servants, death, and stealing of all these things that are belonging to Job. That's the first three. Now, notice how this was introduced. It was introduced back in verse 13 with kind of it's not quite a cliffhanger. That's not the right expression to use, but a suggestive description. Why? Now, there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. Okay, that doesn't seem to fit into any of these losses yet, right? So we're like waiting. Like, is there some implication about they're all together when all this is happening?
I mean, well, based on like the first 12 verses, as you get to the end of those 12 verses, and you get to verse 13, and you know what has just happened in the heavens. Mm-hmm. 13 is ominous.
Oh yeah, very ominous. It's like, oh man.
And the devil, everything... of course, is a maximizer of suffering. So, you know, if verse 18 was instead verse 14, the rest of this doesn't matter.
Yeah, he probably would not have even heard the rest of the reports. So the worst is saved for last. While he, that is the third messenger, while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind, tornado, I suppose, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. So, just indescribable loss. I mean, I can't even begin to wrap my mind around it. I mean, it'd be bad enough if, say you're at work and you get a call from your wife or your neighbor, whoever, and says, hey, just so you know, we just had a tornado come through town and it wiped out your house totally. Mm-hmm. Well, that would be shocking. You know, that'd be kind of one of those events in life that you never forget, that you go in, you know, tell people about the rest of your life. Or, you know, say you basically everything you own gets taken, stolen, destroyed, whatever it might be. that would also be something which would be life altering, which you would just, you know, it'd always kind of be there, at least in the periphery of your vision the whole rest of your life, because it was such a catastrophic loss. But for all of that to happen, one on top of the other, this and then that and then this again, and then finally, worst of all, that you lost every single one of your kids in one fell swoop. There's no way that I can begin to even fathom what that would do to a person.
Well, I mean, Chad, you can probably, in one way, you can. I might be wrong here, but I've never lost a kid, so I have, like, no idea what this is like. You have, which also maybe tells you that you know something what this will be like, or maybe that actually informs you that if you lost all of your children at once, that you actually have no idea what that would be like, right? I mean, like, it would seem almost, you're familiar with a pain that is of that kind, but, like, is it possible to fathom what that would be like amplified 10 times over?
No, I can't. I mean, I don't know how, honestly, it wouldn't just kill me on the spot.
Yeah.
It was, the pain of losing Luke was just incalculable. I mean, you cannot describe what it's like. So to take that and to compound it, not two or three times, but 10 times over.
It seems like it would just kill you, right?
It seemed like it would kill you on the spot. Yeah. Like you would just fall over dead at the news. That's not what Job did. Verse 20 says that rather than falling over, he arose, tore his robe, shaved his head. Then he fell on the ground and worshiped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And then as a closing remark, at the end of this chapter, we're told, "In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong." That could be translated literally, it's he did not give unseemliness to God. Other translations render it, he didn't blame God, didn't charge God foolishly, but you get the gist of it. He's not blaming God for all these things that are happening. Didn't basically say that God was wrong in these things happening.
And this is how you know that Job is, in fact, better than me.
This is how you know that Job is better than any person I've ever known in my entire life.
Because, let me tell you, dude, I mean, apart from like an intervention of the Holy Spirit himself, there is zero chance that this is my response.
Yeah, maybe the tearing the robe and the shaving the head and falling on the ground, whatever the modern equivalent to that would be. I mean, I literally fell to the ground when I heard the news about Luke, but I didn't fall to the ground and worshiped. I just fell to the ground because it's one of those things that literally knocks you off your feet in the most horrendous of ways. But that's not what Job does. He tears his robe, which of course is we've seen that multiple times throughout these books. It's the outward expression of the inward tearing of your heart, more or less.
Yeah.
You know, so rend your heart, not your garments, as one of the prophets says. Shaving of the head is part of the expression of grief, because you like part of mourning is you take away from yourself all those things that maybe beautified you or were normal, whatever it might be. That's why you change your clothes, put on sackcloth or whatever, shave your head, falls to the ground. But the worshiping part, that's hard to imagine. And then not only that, but what he said, his confession is truthful. It's on point. I mean, it's very similar to what Paul said. You know, Paul in 1 Timothy 6 says that we brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of the world. That's more or less what Job says. I came into this world with nothing. I was naked. And when I leave this life, I will also be the same way. The Lord gave everything that I had. I mean, the livestock, the servants, and the children. All of these were gifts from God. And the same Lord that gave these has now taken them away.
Yeah,
blessed be the name of the Lord.
I think if I'm in a situation, probably I'm like outright angry with God. Probably, if I'm not, I'm at least, you know, Psalm 13 with God in this sort of God has most certainly forsaken me and forgotten me. I'm certainly in that place if this happens, where if I'm not like outright angry with him, I'm like, well, God has obviously abandoned me.
Yeah, I think the first reaction that most people are going to have is just almost a numb shock. Mm. Like, you know, it's remarkable to me that his first reaction is Godward. Mm-hmm. You know, that he would, that his first reaction would not be to just be in shock or be confused or just to be utterly overwhelmed by all of these losses to an extent to where he didn't know what to do, what to say. The fact that his first reaction is to engage in these mourning rituals and then to have this confession about God giving and God taking away and blessing the name of the Lord is, yeah, it's something which is unique probably in all human history.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too that you have a couple of different things. I mean, so the devil uses sort of this natural kind of disaster to take out his children as opposed to like, you know, three bands of Chaldeans or whatever that he uses to take out something else. If you had reversed that as well, then your reaction is like to amass everyone you know and tell them to get their weapons because you're about to go exact vengeance. But you don't, when you have it layered up like this, I mean, going and finding the people who killed all your flocks or whatever is, I mean, who cares? You know?
Yeah. He's not going to gather everybody together. Hey, we're going to war against the Sabaeans. No, like you said, after he hears this last, he probably quickly forgot about everything else.
Yeah.
That's all that matters. So, and this, this last verse, in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. I mean, it basically means that he proved Satan wrong. The whole basis of this was that Satan says, oh, yeah. Well, tell you what, you take the hedge away and let me have at him, and he'll curse you to your face. But he didn't. He did quite the opposite. He worshiped, blessed God.
Yeah, that's sort of round one to Job, right?
Yeah, it's round one to Job and to Job's God. So Satan, you're wrong. Didn't work. You thought it was going to work, but you were gravely mistaken. So that's Job 1, and unfortunately, that's not the end of Job's sufferings, because we've got Job 2 coming up. We have another conversation between God and Satan that's going to take place in the heavenly realm. So chapter 2, again, there was a day when the sons of God, these angelic beings we talked about in the last episode, came to present themselves before the Lord, and here we have the Satan also coming among them to present himself to the Lord. So this is a repeat, same kind of heavenly scenario that we saw last time. And another kind of dialogue that follows along the same path, at least at first, because God says to Satan, where'd you come from? And Satan answers, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. And then once more, God says to him, have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. So all that is basically the same thing that we saw before. Satan appears, angels are there, God strikes up a dialogue, says, hey, have you considered my servant Job? Now what changes is at the very end of kind of halfway through verse 3. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. For integrity is very close to the word for blameless that we saw back in verse 1 of chapter 1. It's kind of the same idea, you know, that he's blameless, he's got integrity, he's holding fast to this despite everything that's happened to Job.
And this line is like a little bit troubling, right? Where you have this, hey, he's holding fast to his integrity.
Part.
Yeah, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. You're like, wait a minute, why don't you say, even though you challenged me to let you torment him or cause him to suffer, this sort of God taking responsibility is Like that's something that you got to struggle with.
Yeah, and I think it you have to struggle with it, and it rings true with the whole rest of the book too, because at least when Job after this chapter, when Job begins to lament, argue, complain, demand his day in court. Of course, Job doesn't know what happened with regard to Satan and all that, but Job always is concerned about what God is doing. He's never concerned about, like, how dare you let Satan do all these things to me? So well, even the way that Job presents his arguments is that, like, God is responsible for this, not anybody else.
I do like, I think there's a lesson there about Job is never devil focused. Like, I mean, God, he's always God focused. Like, so we might be tempted. And maybe you would say, oh, well, Job, you're wrong. What you should be saying is the devil has done this. But Job doesn't ever think that way. And maybe we ought to think less that way, that like, oh, the devil's really got it out for me. I mean, he even says the Lord is given and the Lord has taken away. And well, I think what we would like to do sometimes is say, no, no, the Lord is given, but the devil has taken away. But Job doesn't think the devil has that kind of power.
No, no. Yeah. Well, it's pretty typical of the Old Testament to understand that the buck always stops with God.
They understand what sovereignty means, right?
Yes, yes. You know, even though they might acknowledge the fact, okay, the Babylonians did this or, you know, whatever it might be. Ultimately, that is one thing that is very clear from all kinds of Old Testament narratives is ultimately, they understand that nothing happens outside of God's involvement. Let's put it like that. So Satan does not, as it were, hold sway apart from being underneath God.
Yeah, this is Luther's The Devil is God's Devil. And this is not to say that that God is sort of working with the devil, but what it means is that the devil does and has a higher authority. They are not some sort of equals. Do you even see, not only do the people in the Old Testament view it that way, but you see God say things like this, in Habakkuk, which we'll get to someday, you know, when he's crying out, and God will say things like, behold, I am sending I'm sending the Chaldeans, right? And so, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait a minute, what? Like, what do you mean you're sending them? It's like they want to come over here and destroy these people, and God is saying, is God sending them? Well, what he's saying is, I'm not stopping them. Mm-hmm. And then later on, he'll say, how dare these Chaldeans come against my people?
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to hold all these things together.
Yeah. So just this weekend, I was leading a men's retreat up in the Rockies. It's a little ways outside of Colorado Springs. And we were talking about Joseph. And there's that great line, you know, in when Joseph's dialogue with his brothers. So you sold me here, but God sent me here. Mm-hmm. So we want to say, oh, wait, no, which is it? Did the brothers sell you there or did God send you there? But the Bible won't allow for those sort of like separated dichotomies. It's like, okay, you sold me here. Yes, obviously you did wrong in doing that, but God sent me here.
Yeah. That's how it is. Like, did God
hold those things in tension?
Yeah. Did God send the Chaldeans or did he hold the Chaldeans responsible for the hubris of coming against his people? And the answer is yeah. That's how that happened.
That's how this happened, yeah. Or my favorite example that always is in Acts, when Peter says, you know, basically, you crucified the Messiah according to the predetermined foreknowledge and plan of God.
Yeah.
So you don't get off the hook for your sin, just like, you know, all these raiders or whatever, they don't get off the hook for that either, or the Chaldeans. But at the same time, you have to acknowledge that the hand of God was involved in this in some way, because nothing happens outside of his sovereignty.
Yeah.
I think that we've mentioned sovereignty more in this episode than we all have in all the other episodes.
Yes. Well, and it's when you think about sovereignty, there's one way to think about it. Some people will, in the midst of suffering, you know, they'll say something like, well, you know, God's in control. And I actually don't like that, because I actually don't think that's very comforting. Because if you read the Bible, you're like, yeah, well, he is. But also, there's a lot of pain and suffering and hardship that God allows in his sovereignty. So I don't know that like God being in control is like really that like, hey, don't worry, there's an all-powerful being. You're like, okay, like, but I don't know if he's for this, against this, involved in this. Like, is he exercising that power for my good? The only way that you can be comforted in the sovereignty of God is through the cross. Like, so that this is then the comfort. Is that, hey, there's someone who is sovereign who has made particular promises, who has followed through on those particular promises for your good. So sovereignty in and of itself is not comforting.
No, sovereignty across from the cross is terrifying.
Yes.
Yeah. So sovereignty, true. But the only way that I know that this all-powerful God is actually for me is in the cross. Then all of a sudden, yeah, okay, then I can take comfort in the fact that there's an all-powerful God, because I know that that all-powerful God became one of us and was crucified for us and for our salvation. There's comfort. But just kind of the blanket statement, oh, God is in control or God is all-powerful, that doesn't mean anything. What if this all-powerful God is my enemy out to get me?
Yeah, the cross tells you who God is, man. Otherwise, it's just like, hey, there's an all-powerful God, and this could really do is just make you angry. It's like, yeah, well, I wish he would wake up and exercise some of that sovereignty on my behalf. He obviously doesn't care about me. Like, I mean, if you're just suffering and you don't have the cross, this just means that God is indifferent at the very best, like, to your suffering. But the cross tells you otherwise.
Yeah, and there's nothing distinctly Christian about acknowledging the sovereignty of God.
No.
Well, that's pretty much across monotheistic religions, acknowledge, yeah, he's all powerful. Okay, that doesn't really get you anywhere. The only way you get somewhere toward comfort is knowing that this sovereign God is actually for you in Jesus Christ.
And that this God has promised, like, in this life you will have trials, you will have hardships, you will suffer many things, but take heart, I have overcome the world. This is like the only way to have actual comfort. It's not that you will not suffer in this world, but that he has overcome this world. And there's like a promise for you in the midst of suffering and on the other side of suffering.
Yeah. Amen. All right. So verse 3, God has said this about Job. So Satan's going to respond. And the first thing he says when he answers the Lord is, skin for skin. So
evil, doesn't it? I mean, that
it really does.
That just sounds like that sounds like the Emperor from Star Wars, something he like, you got some voice like that. That just sounds like Halloween on 11, dude. Like skin for skin. What is
skin
that?
For skin. Yeah. 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 So I checked out the commentator. There's like five different explanations of that. Here's the one I found most convincing, and I think it rings true here. So the most convincing argument is that Satan is saying to God, if you touch his skin, he's going to want to strike back against your skin. So just like, you know, you hit somebody in the face, their first reaction is going to hit you back in the face. So you touch his skin, he's going to like launch an attack against you by cursing you. So that's one explanation. Whatever it means, it's pretty sinister sounding, skin for skin.
Yeah, it almost seems like, hey, I'm trying to get, you're saying that he will not do this thing in and with his body, which is curse you, which is a something you would do with your mouth. This is something you would do with your person, right? Even if it is just words, this would be something you would say. And so there is this, does seem like there is sort of this, well, I've done a lot of stuff to him, but if I want to elicit a response out of him, out of his body, I'm going to need to touch his body, right? Yeah. So, like, well, you let me at his body, and we'll see what that body does. My guess Game's is that over. Tongue will start saying things.
Yeah. So, skin for skin. All that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. So, yeah, you've taken away all the stuff external to him. I mean, if you can consider your kids external to you, I mean, it's they are, but they're not. But anyway, you touch his actual body, bones and flesh, and that will result in him cursing you to your face. And God says to Satan, behold, he is in your hand. That's kind of a little switch there. Satan says, stretch out your hand and touch his bone and flesh. The Lord says, Satan, behold, he's in your hand. And then he adds only, literally it's like guard his life or keep his life, usually translated spare his life. So you can do what you're going to do where you touch his bone and his flesh. The only thing you can't do, and this, you know, gets back more to the, he can only go as far as God lets him go. You can't kill him. He's going to stay alive. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with something that was just incredibly painful, debilitating, disfiguring, that had a stench to it. Just imagine the worst possible physical condition you could ever have that would afflict you from your head to your toe, just make you like no longer to where people could even recognize you. Well, that's what you're looking at here. So yeah, it's translated here as loathsome sores.
Yeah, you're talking about everywhere too, like the soles of your feet to the crown of your head.
Oh yeah, yeah.
No position to sit in or lay in to be comfortable. I mean, just everywhere.
Yeah, I think most commentators think this is like some sort of leprosy, whatever it was, you know, some sort of leprosy kind of disease. So anyway, that's what he has, and takes a pottery shard, piece of broken pottery, and he starts to kind of scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. So just in case you didn't already have this grotesque image in your mind, now picture him sitting on the ashes, and the ashes is used in different ways. I mean, of course, we're familiar with sackcloth and ashes. Ashes could also refer to basically the city dump, place where they burned, you know, the garbage or whatever. So maybe that's where he's at. Maybe he's just in some place where ashes were collected, and I don't know why he would be there, except maybe just kind of continue this theme of mourning and grief.
Dude, I know this. At this point, even though theologically I know that this is incorrect, I might be saying to Chad, if this all happened to me, dude, we got to figure out why God's so upset with me. Like, what did I, like, I'm trying to figure out exactly why he is so opposed to me right now. Like, what is going, I mean, I don't know. How could you possibly, like, all this stuff happens in a row, but to be like, I'm being judged. There's no other explanation. I am completely being judged right now.
Oh yeah, I'd be doing a major inventory of all my past actions to figure out what it was that really turned God against me.
Yeah, even though I know that's not how this works, but I, at this point, my theology might change based on experience, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm with you. Mine would too. So there he is. Not only did he experience all of the loss of all his possessions and, worst of all, his children.
At least his wonderful...
Now he's lost his health.
And at least his wonderful wife is around to comfort him through all this. That was nice of the devil to leave her around so that she could be a source of...
She is still there, and she's got something to say in verse 9. So his wife comes up, and she's been called some pretty terrible things. So let's look at this morning. Augustine calls her the devil's accomplice. Chrysostom calls her the devil's best scourge. Calvin calls her the organ of Satan. I didn't look up Luther. I don't know what he has to say, but, and there's a sampling anyway of different things that people have said about her. I mean, so before we get to her speech, I mean, you have to kind of step back and be like, yeah, but you know, everything that Job lost, she did too. Wasn't like she is somehow separated from these losses. These were her kids and Job's kids, her possessions and Job's possessions. Now, the way she reacts to it, though.
Yeah, well, you could think. Imagine this. So this all happens before you get your body you know, afflicted with loathsome sores. You, if you're his wife, you might be thinking, it doesn't seem like she's maybe like the best person in the world. Maybe, you know, whose fault is this? Is this Joe's fault? Maybe this is her fault. Like, I don't know. Like, you're sort of both have lost everything. But now Job is now afflicted. And I'm sure in this moment, she's like, ah, I think we know which of us it was.
Yeah, if you're basing your theology on evidence, the finger, the accusing finger would be pointing at Job.
I don't have sores.
I mean, I'm heartbroken, but I'm not sitting around on ashes scraping my skin from head to toe.
So there could be a little. I feel like there's some accusation in this. I mean, obviously, I'm sure she's hurting, but also at this point, perhaps she is angry and would also like to know, what exactly did you do, Job, that caused this all to happen? Because this is quite obviously your fault.
Yeah. So she says, do you still hold fast your integrity? That's what's strange is that she's echoing the very words of God, right? He says to Satan, Job still holds fast his integrity. She says, do you still hold fast your integrity? And then she has this famous line, infamous line, curse God and die.
Do you think that this hold fast your integrity is a dig here? Like, to me, I might be wrong here, but I read this as, are you still pretending?
Yeah, hearing it from the mouth of God is one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, he says to Satan, do you still hold fast your integrity? All right. We understand that's coming from God. It's truthful. But yeah, you do kind of pick up maybe the same words, but kind of twisted. Yeah.
Are you still hold fast your integrity? Are you still pretending like you are righteous?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, look around, I mean, nobody's buying this.
It certainly seems that way based upon what she tells him to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if she really believed he had integrity, then she would have said, well, okay, well then continue to bless God and maybe he grant you healing, whatever, you know, not curse God and die, not basically say something which is going to result in God smiting you dead. It's more or less. So this is why don't you just commit suicide by cursing God?
Yeah, it seems like a statement that is saying you can stop pretending like God is for you or that you and God are in some kind of good relationship. Like you are playing a game that everyone can see through.
Yeah.
So why don't you just say what we all know?
And notice her view of God too. I mean, she thinks that if he curses God, he's going to die.
Mm.
It's also a twisted view of God that, you know, if you curse him, it's over.
Yeah.
He's going to smite you down. So she has a very kind of tit for tat.
We'd all be dead, Chad.
We'd all be dead. Long ago. So he responds this way. You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. And this is the other kind of the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away line of Job. This is the other kind of summary line of his the way he views this. Shall we receive good from God and shall we not receive evil? So Tov and Ra are the two Hebrew extremes there. And evil could be translated, it's one of these words, Ra is one of these words that can be, you know, everything from ugly to bad to unpleasant to evil. So we're just looking at two extremes here. Shall we receive this good, but not this bad? And then we have a summary statement. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now that concluding phrase, with his lips, I know some rabbis took this to mean that he was sinning in his heart. He just didn't sin with his speech. I don't know about that. I'm not sold on that idea. Just because, at least at this point, everything that's been presented about Job shows him as blameless and a man of integrity. So maybe that's what's implied there. I think it's basically saying that, listen, he didn't do what she said to do. He didn't curse God. He just kept on saying the right kind of thing and believing the right kind of thing.
Yeah, and I don't know how all the ancient rabbis viewed it and stuff, but like I know in more modern rabbis, at least a lot of the ones I've heard, that distinction wouldn't matter that much anyway, because ultimately, what what's going on in your heart is not the issue. It's what it's it would be what you do with your lips or what you do with your hands. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very much did you do the action, not did you desire to?
Yeah, it's a very, very external works oriented kind of righteousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're at the end of our 40 minutes. Yeah. So we'll actually, it worked out well. I mean, it's not the end of the chapter, but it's the next thing we'll have the introduction of Job's three friends, which actually would be it's a good way to transition into what follows, because we're going to have this back and forth between Job and his three friends over the course of the next bunch of chapters. So we'll pick that up next time.
Sounds good. All right. Well, join us next week. It's a bummer so far. Job, round two goes to Job. We are going to see what kind of friends he has. You know, let's see what kind of buddies he has, and if they can help him out or not. We'll discover that next week. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right. See you then.